My guest, Father Andrew Greeley, has written numerous best-selling novels, including Younger Than Springtime, A Midwinter's Tale, Irish Mist, Contract with an Angel. More than 15 million copies of his books are in print. He divides his time between teaching at the University of Chicago and the University of Arizona at Tucson. Many have called him one of America's most controversial priests. I would argue that he defines the very meaning of what it is to be a parish priest. He's here, and he's just published the second volume of his memories of his autobiography. It is entitled, Furthermore, Memories of a Parish Priest. Father Andrew Greeley, thanks so much for being with us.
Nice to be with you.
First of all, how would you define, as we move into the 21st century, what you see as the role of a parish priest in contemporary society?
I don't think it's changed much since the beginning. I mean, the priest stands somewhere between God and humankind. As the Hebrew says, he's taken among men so he understands the trials and troubles of being human. But he also is taken for the things that pertain to God. So we stand between God and humans, kind of mediating as best we can.
And do you think that the fact, or at least the argument, that human life has become more complicated, that those trials and tribulations have become more intense and more involved, do you think that that is a factor in this?
Well, you know, it's a mixed picture. On the one hand, we live a lot longer, we live a lot better. On the other hand, we have a lot more time to think and reflect and worry. So if anything, I think priests or priest-like people are needed more than ever before. And if there is a shortage of priests, as there is in the Catholic Church today, the demands on them are just going to be enormous.
And what do you think is the underlying reason? I mean, there are many things that have been thrown out as possible explanations. What do you see as the reason why there is such a shortage of priests in the Catholic Church today?
Well, I think priests don't recruit anymore. Three-quarters of the priests in the country, in a survey done by the Los Angeles Times, say that being a priest is better than they thought it would be, and only 9% say that it's worse. But somehow or the other, priests have the impression that the morale of everybody else is bad, and so they're reluctant to recruit. That, I think, is the core problem. Of course, I think if we had married priests, the problem would be solved overnight.
Mm-hmm. What are your views on that?
Well, I think much of what I've done, much of the trouble I've got myself into, I never could have done if I was a married man. So celibacy has been very much part of my vocation. I wouldn't give it up if I could. But I do understand that with much longer lives, the issue is very complicated.
And do you think that it's an issue that is ever going to be satisfactorily resolved?
Oh, it could be resolved tomorrow if the Pope should wake up in the morning and say, all right, we can have married priests.
Mm-hmm.
We did for much of Catholic history, and it's a purely a disciplinary matter. Pope could change it tomorrow.
But there's very little likelihood that's going to happen, that either this Pope or probably the next Pope is going to do anything in that regard.
Well, that depends on who the next Pope is, of course. It is said, some Protestant observer said, it would be the next papacy and a half before it happens. But mm-hmm. I think it is relatively near.
Mm-hmm.
Then I say, it's too late for me.
Too late for you. Talk about what you put into the second volume of your autobiography that you didn't include the first time around. What were some of the things that you thought it was important enough to get out there?
Well, the things that happened in the last 15 years since the Confessions of a Parish Priest came out gave me a richer and deeper perspective of what's happened to the American Church since I was ordained. And also has, some would say I've mellowed, I don't think so, but at least I've learned to laugh off the people that hate me.
Why do people think that you've mellowed?
Well, because they think that I'm much better able to ignore the critics and I get in fewer arguments than I've done before.
Is that mellowing or is that just the wisdom to pick and choose battles and know which ones are worth fighting?
I think and hope it's the latter, yeah.
Mm-hmm.
Because in this book I describe a fearsome battle over the pedophile controversy.
I want to talk about that, but I want to talk more about what you perceive to be the public attitude towards religion in general. You travel around the country. There is constant religious discussion going on in public quarters these days, perhaps more so than in a very long time. It has entered into the political debate. Do you think that there's anything that is coming out of that discussion that is useful?
No. No, I think what has happened is that the evangelical movement has become more visible around the country, and people of that persuasion essentially control the House of Representatives. And in the Republican Party especially, keeping its evangelical wing happy is something that's very important to them. So they have to touch base periodically and purport to be religious. And I have mixed emotions about Bill Bradley. On the one hand, he's been perfectly candid. This is his own private life. He's not going to talk about it. On the other hand, he played in the New York Knicks, and that's the unforgivable sin.
Well, that's only because you're a Chicago Bulls fan, big time, for those that don't know. In fact, we should point out that there you are standing on the cover with your Chicago Bulls jacket on.
Yeah, well, I used to wear it with pride. Now I wear it as a memorial.
As a memorial. I want to continue along the lines of politicians wearing their religion on their sleeves. Somebody wrote a column just the other day about the fact that when Kennedy ran for president 35-plus years ago, that the subject of religion was essentially taboo, that the whole object was to separate religion from politics, and now it has become almost a requirement for people running for office, Republicans and Democrats alike. I mean, I think that Al Gore.
Yeah, well, I think that it has become critical after the 1994 election, which turned Congress over to hordes of fundamentalists, the kinds of people who won't even let a Catholic priest be chaplain of the House of Representatives. So I think that these people are committed religious and talk about it constantly, and go to prayer breakfasts publicly. I think this has brought the religious issue into the fore.
And how
how do you deduce, for example, the appropriate American response to China from the Gospels? I mean, I don't know. I think an attempt to draw, let us say, a China policy or a policy on the death penalty directly from the words of the Gospel is dangerously close to idolatry.
Uh-huh. And how do you justify, or how do you explain, as you look at it, the degree of intolerance among so many people that claim religion as a mantle?
Well, religion has never really been immune to the temptation to fanaticism. And I think there's a lot of fanaticism out there that in our country today that wears a religious guise.
Uh-huh. One of the things that you mentioned, the pedophile controversy before, and you mentioned the morale among the Catholic Church. Talk a little bit about that and what you find in terms of morale as you travel around the country. Is the morale really as bad as we're led to believe, or are there just pockets of it that seem to be so blown up in terms of the reporting of it?
Well, the pedophile thing is international. I mean, we Americans have no monopoly on it. We became honest about it a lot earlier than they have in other countries. Most pedophiles are married men. They prey on their own children, on their nieces and nephews. Celibacy doesn't cause pedophilia, and a married priesthood won't make it go away. It's a problem that affects any institution where adults have disproportionate power over children. Education, scouting, athletics, clergy of all denominations. But the problem with the Catholic Church is it's covered up, it's stonewalled. It reassigned people to parishes after they'd been after we knew they preyed on children. And having sowed the wind, we reaped the whirlwind. Mm-hmm. The whirlwind.
How much more power and persuasiveness do you think that the church would have if it didn't engage in cover-ups and it dealt with this out in the open and it dealt with it in a much more straightforward way?
Well, that's the way it should have always been done. And in some places in the country, including my own archdiocese, that's the way it is done. But they're still fighting these things in courts in some places, trying to beat the victims and their families into the ground.
You were talking about worldwide issues before. You were talking about the worldwide problems, and you mentioned China before. Talk about the difference between the Catholic Church in America and the Catholic Church in other parts of the world.
Well, I think what we still have in this country is a very strong Catholic community. I mean, where you have parishes with reasonably sensible and reasonably secure pastors, you have religious enthusiasm, which human history has never witnessed before. So out in the parishes where there's good leadership, and there isn't in all of them, God knows, the church is in fine shape, better shape than it might be anywhere else in the world.
What about in Latin America?
Well, Latin America is religiously speaking, a mess. The church, for ages, has been on the sides of the political reactionaries, the military, the aristocracy, the landowners, the rich people. And then more recently, it decided, well, it was going to be on the side of the poor, and it began to view the world through a Marxist prism. That it shouldn't be on anybody's side, or rather it should be on everybody's side, doesn't seem to have occurred to people down there yet. They have a long, long way to go.
And how are they going to dig themselves out of that morass? I mean, the points you make, I think, are great. And I agree that they have a long way to go, but where do they go? What are the steps that you think they need to take, that the church needs to take?
In South America, I don't have any idea. I've visited the countries down there, and I've observed, and I've talked to people, and I've learned enough to know that I don't know anything.
You have written, I was mentioning in the introduction, you have written, in addition to nonfiction, tremendous numbers of works of fiction, and you have a great respect for the role of imagination in religious life. Talk about that.
Well, I think religion begins in stories and ends in stories. We learn religion, first of all, usually from our mother and father in the stories they tell us, Easter, Christmas, Passover. And then we go to school and we begin to learn propositional religion, or in school or in Sunday school. And we then go off to high school and college and begin to question some of these propositions. And we re-examine them and unpack them and then try to put them together and return to the faith, no longer simple but complex, but as contained in the story. So the propositional prose religion is between two sets of stories.
George Weigel, who has recently written a biography of Pope John Paul, talks a lot early on in the book about John Paul's understanding of the power of story and the power of narrative, part of it coming out even of his training as an actor early on, and that he believes has been responsible in some respects for the success of his message and the success of his papacy. Your thoughts about that?
Well, I rarely agree with Dr. Weigel, but I would agree with this, that the Pope is a superb storyteller. How successful his administration in the papacy has been, I guess we better leave to history.
Mm-hmm. And what are your views about its success or lack of success at this point in time?
Well, certainly he has represented Catholicism all over the world in a dramatic way, and he's had some impact on what happened in Eastern Europe, though I think those who say he's responsible for the fall of communism in Eastern Europe, as Professor Weigel suggests, I think they exaggerate the nature of his impact. Inside the church, he has made, I think, as one of his principal goals, to reverse the decline of the Catholic sexual ethic. And in this, he simply failed.
And what would you like to see the next papacy undertake as its primary goal, if it was your choice?
Oh, I would like to see them start listening to what's going on out in the grassroots. The fundamental structural flaw of Catholicism, the way it's organized today, is that there's no effective way of listening. Mm-hmm. The Holy Spirit speaks to us indeed through the leadership of the church, but also through the people of God. Consensus fidelium, as we used to say in Latin. And I don't think there's any good way from the parish on up of the institution knowing what the people are thinking and feeling and saying.
Mm-hmm. And how does this affect the relationship between the Catholic Church in America and the Vatican?
Well, the Vatican takes a very dim view of us. They think we're materialists and secularists and consumerists and sex mad. And that's most unfortunate, because it is a caricature of American Catholicism, which is enormously generous, dedicated, generous with its money, generous with its time and energy. That part of the reason for the breakdown between the church in this country and the Vatican is that the Vatican thinks it has us all figured out, and really hasn't.
And has there been no way at all for any members of the church, any powers that be within the church in America, to communicate this to the Vatican?
Oh, I think they've tried, but it's pretty hard to change the minds of people who've already made up their mind.
I want to talk a little bit about one of the other issues that you write about, and I know you've talked about, which is the role of Catholic schools and how that fits into contemporary education and the whole notion of vouchers and public education.
Well, I personally support vouchers. I'm not sure whether we're going to get them. And I don't think the Catholic schools need them to survive. We can survive as we have through the years without the vouchers. It would be helpful, probably would be discriminatory legally, but it would be helpful if the vouchers were limited to poor people and to minorities. The success of the Catholic schools, which I think even some of the members of the public school bureaucracy will admit, the success comes from the fact that we make stricter demands on people, and we provide more personal attention to students and more community support. Professor Anthony Bryke, in his book Catholic Schools and the Common Good, has pretty much proved that to be true. So for minority folks, Catholic schools are a real bargain. It's private education, effective private education, at much lower cost than if you went to another private school.
Is there a hierarchical structure in Catholic schools, not unlike the hierarchical structure you were talking about vis-a-vis the Vatican, that is also part of the educational process, and is that somehow a positive element of it?
Well, I think it, the first thing that Professor Bryke found, and I was quoting, was that Catholic schools are better able to make demands on their students.
Uh-huh.
So that's a dimension of the authority or hierarchical structure. You know, you can say to a kid that's goofing off, say, I know your mother's phone number.
Uh-huh. One of the things that you talk about in Furthermore is the whole idea of politics within the church, and we've been touching on many of the different attitudes in the church. And when we're talking about politics, liberal versus conservative, they have certain code words and they have certain meanings. They have a different meaning within the church. Talk a little bit about what you perceive to be the differences between the liberal and the more conservative elements within the Catholic Church.
You know, it's easy, relatively easy, to outline that. I mean, the conservatives want no more changes, and they'd like to undo some of the changes. And the liberals want more changes. They want more democratization of the church. They want more lay participation, election of pastors and bishops, and maybe even the Pope. But in fact, most Catholics, while they may define themselves as traditional or moderate or progressive, it really doesn't fit those categories too well, because even the mm-hmm. Catholics who describe themselves as traditional are likely to think that premarital sex may sometimes not be wrong, for example,
mm-hmm.
or are likely to think that birth control is all right. So there, that label, that paradigm of labels, is not a very good way of sorting out Catholics.
And if the next papacy is a more conservative one in terms of the labels as we're using them here, and the church continues to move in that direction, what do you think the future is of the church in this country?
Well, I don't think that's going to happen. I think the next pope, one of the iron rules of papal election is the new pope is always different from the last pope, and I think that whoever the next pope is, he may be only marginally less conservative in his ideas, but I think his style will be very different from the present popes.
Mm-hmm.
But, you know, we've had 30 years of turbulence and trauma in the church, and the defection rate hasn't changed one bit. I mean, as I often say, we priests, bishops, the Vatican, done our best to drive the Catholic folk out of the church, and they won't go. They like being Catholic.
But there is this shortage of priests, as you were talking about at the outset of our conversation, and it seems like it certainly in the direction things are going, that shortage will continue, and that many of the older priests will at some point leave the church or move on or retire or pass away. Where does it look to for its energy?
Well, it looks to for its energy where it always has had to look, to the lay people. And the priests can only do what the lay people let them do or help them to do. So I think the shortage of priests is a terrible problem. I think the church will survive it.
Mm-hmm. I want to come back to one other political issue. Part of the political debate that has been going on, I know you speak about this in the book in several ways, has been that we need to rely less on government efforts and government programs and put more and more responsibility in the hands of churches and religious organizations. As a parish priest, how do you respond to that?
But I think it's true that that local groups can more effectively deal with social problems than distant governmental bureaucracies. And so I do think, particularly in the African-American community, the strength of the African-American church is such that it is an enormous positive force in the community and should be supported as best it can, best we can. But I also think there's still plenty of room for government intervention because local groups and the churches can do a lot, but they can't do everything.
Uh-huh. What about in terms of the Catholic Church? What would you like to see more of done on a local level among parishes?
Oh, more respect for women and better sermons. Those are our two biggest problems. You know, it's not the Vatican, it's not the Chancery Office. It's that the sermons are very poor on the average, at least lay people think so. And women don't feel they get any respect.
Father Andrew Greeley, the second volume of his autobiography is entitled Furthermore, Memories of a Parish Priest. It's been an honor and a pleasure to have you on the program today. I appreciate it.
Nice to talk to you.
Thank you so much. Yeah. We'll take a break. We'll come right back.